Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, special coverage of the Boston Marathon 6 years after the bombings.
In the end, what we're all trying to do in our different ways is turn it to a positive, isn't it? To say, look, we won't let these terrorists divide us. We won't let you make us fearful, hateful of each other. In fact, you know, we're going to do the opposite. We're going to come together and stand strong together.
I have no control over how they took my leg, but I do have control over how they take the day.
We kind of gotten complacent after 9/11, and it woke us back up again that we need to be resilient, and I think we were.
We'll also check in with WBUR reporters to get the latest from the course. Also today, with Game of Thrones back on TV, what lessons can the hit show teach us about medieval history? That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. We begin with the 123rd running of the Boston Marathon. More than 30,000 runners took off from Hopkinton this morning, and while the elite competitors have already finished, there are plenty of folks who will be crossing the finish line on Boylston Street this hour and later this afternoon. We'll be checking in on the marathon throughout the show, starting at the finish line with WBUR's marathon reporter, Alex Ashlock, joining us as he does every year from Boylston Street. Hey there, Alex.
Hey, Callum, how you doing?
I'm well. I'm drier than you are, probably. And I know that you were on the women's lead truck for the race today when it was really coming down. So let's start there. Ethiopia's Werknesh Degefa just dominated today's race. How impressive was the race she ran today?
You know, I've never really seen a marathoner here at Boston run a race like she did today. She dominated from about 5K into the race. That's about 3 miles in. There was a big pack of women. They all ran about the same time for the first 5K. And then she started to run faster. She ran the second 5K more than a minute faster than she ran the first 5K. That really whittled down the pack. Then she ran another fast 5K, and she just disappeared from the rest of the field. We were in the press truck, on the press truck, and there were many times when all we could see was Werknesh. We couldn't see any other runners on the race course behind her. So it was just an amazing performance by this runner from Ethiopia who'd never run Boston before.
So was it ever really in doubt, Alex? I mean, we saw a second-place finisher, Edna Kiplagat, who won Boston a couple of years ago, make a strong push toward the end, but it was just too little too late.
Yeah, it was too little too late. At one point, she was Werknesh Degefa was 4.5 minutes in front of the rest of the field. And Edna Kiplagat did make a noble effort. She really whittled down that lead because she ended up finishing second by less than a minute. So she came back, but nobody else did. And Degefa just had an insurmountable lead. When we were on the truck, we were watching the volunteers. When she would come through a water station and get some water, all the volunteers would sort of lean out into the street, looking down the street to see if anybody else was coming. And for the most part, nobody else was.
Wow, really impressive. And how about defending champ Desiree Linden, Alex? I mean, she won a lot of hearts last year as the first American woman to win the race in a long time, won it in really tough conditions. She was fifth today. So would you call that a disappointment, or was it just a really deep field?
No, I think it wouldn't be a disappointment. It was a very deep field. Conditions were different than they were last year. Des Linden has run here several times. She's always run really well and really aggressively. Last year was her year. She came out on top. She says that's made her career. It'll always be the highlight of her resume. But she's certainly not done by any stretch of the imagination. She'll be in the Olympic trials, I imagine, next year and maybe make the team again. That would be her third Olympic team. Nobody's ever done that. No woman's ever done that in the marathon. So I think she'll be back. She wasn't disappointed today. I mean, of course, she would have liked to have won again. But it was a tough race. And, you know, Werknesh Degefa just took ownership of it.
All right, so the women's race was a blowout, but on the men's side, Alex, it was anything but. I know that you were on the women's truck, but I got to ask you about the closest Boston Marathon finish ever for the men. It came down to Lawrence Chirono and Lisa DeSissa just battling it out on the home stretch. What was the atmosphere like as they were dueling it out?
Oh, that was incredible. And again, as you said, it was just such a different atmosphere from the women's race. They were really two different races. These guys are just battling their way down Boylston Street. Chirono had never run Boston before until today. Lalisa DeSissa of Ethiopia, he's won here twice, including 2013 and 2015. He actually had a little bit of a lead as they were coming close to the tape, but Chirono just edged him out, and it was only, again, by 2 seconds that he was able to win that race. So, again, quite a contrast to the women's race and a real display of sprinting down the stretch here on Boylston Street by these African runners.
So a historically close men's competition, and we also had some history, Alex, in the wheelchair divisions. American Daniel Romanchuk was the first American to win that contest since 1993, and he's also the youngest winner ever at just 20 years old. How impressed were you by his performance today?
I've been watching him for a couple of years now. I saw him win the New York Marathon back in November. I think he may have also won Chicago in the fall as well. He's a rising star. I think he's going to be one of the top men's wheelchair racers for many years to come. I don't know if he's going to approach Ernst van Dijk, the South African who won here 10 times. Nobody's ever won more than that. I don't know if he's going to get to that level, but he, at 20 years old, he just has a very bright future. He'll be competing in London later this month, April 28th, the London Marathon. Wouldn't be surprised to see him win that race as well. He's just a really bright star in the men's wheelchair racing world.
Well, and speaking of that London race in a couple of weeks, we'll also have the women's champion, Manuela Schaar, going for the sweep of the World Marathon Majors, Alex, right? She now holds five of the six major titles at one time. It's just remarkable.
It is remarkable. These athletes, usually the London Marathon is the week right after Boston, but this year it's another week later. I think it's because of Easter next weekend. But anyway, they usually go to London right after Boston, so it's amazing what they do. And as you said, she now holds five of the six World Major Marathon titles. She won Boston in 2017. We knew she was good. We knew she would be competitive today, and she came out on top. American Tatiana McFadden finishing second in the wheelchair race on the women's side. She actually had an accident today. She flipped her chair at about the 6 mile mark. Didn't come out of the chair, but she flipped it. Had to right herself and get back in the race. But I don't think it would have made much difference, even if she had been able to stay righted the whole way, because Manuela Schaar just dominated and won this race pretty easily today in the women's wheelchair.
And boy, McFadden is tough, though, right? The multiple Olympic champion,
too. She really is tough. It would have been 6 wins for her here. She already has 5.
So, Alex, you know, today's race marks the 6th anniversary to the day of the 2013 marathon bombing, and the city, as it has customarily, held a moment of silence with a bell ringing at 2:49, marking the time of the first explosion. So, Alex,
it was really emotional.
Just give us a sense of what was going on during that moment.
It was really interesting, Callum, because you know, they're trying to do sort of a reflection about the anniversary, the actual moment the first bomb went off. At the same time, you have thousands of runners crossing the finish line, you know, pretty much just as they did on the day of the bombing.
Right.
So it was an interesting moment of, you know, remembering the tragedy of that day, the horrible tragedy of that day 6 years ago. But at the same time, in a way, almost celebrating that the marathon is, you know, still going on. People are still finishing, and in fact, people are still finishing out there right now. So it was interesting to have the two things coincide for the first time since 2013 today. It's been an interesting day to watch all the things that have been happening here.
WBUR's Alex Ashlock at the finish line. Alex, thanks for being with us. Stand by. We'll catch up with you a little bit later in the show.
Okay, I'll be here.
And a little bit earlier today, we connected with Roseanne Sedoya. She was in the crowd on Boylston Street in 2013 when the bombs went off, and she lost part of her right leg. Sedoya is now a motivational speaker and author of the book Perfect Strangers. And she was just about to head over to the race course when we spoke, beginning with how she's doing now, 6 years after the attack.
You know, I'm good. I mean, I think every day is different, and for the majority of it is good, but being an amputee, every time you get out of bed, it's always an interesting day. So, and I do think in life we all have our issues and our complaints, but I really, you know, don't have anything too much to complain about.
Well, I remember when we caught up with you around this time last year, you said that you still wake up sometimes and say, oh my God, I don't have a leg. I mean, does that feeling ever go away? You still do that?
I still do that, yes. Yep.
And how are you reflecting on today, on the anniversary, with the marathon and the bombing anniversary falling on the same day for the first time? You know, in past years, there's been some separation. We could celebrate race day and mark the anniversary, and today they converge.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because for me, you know, 5-6 years ago, it wasn't so much April 15th that was important to me as more so the marathon. And it's weird to have both of them on the same day today. And it's a little uneasy in thinking about it, you know, but I'm going to continue to try to do what I've done every year and head in. And over the last 6 years, I've gone in and supported, or I should say 5 years, because she didn't start the foundation until about a year after, but go in and support the Heather Abbott Foundation, which was formed by Heather Abbott, who was also a victim of the bombing and a fellow amputee these days.
And can I ask how your husband, Mike Materia, is doing? I mean, you two are your two halves of this remarkable story, right? He's this Boston firefighter who helped save your life 6 years ago. You ended up marrying one another. I understand he even ran the marathon last year as a way of kind of reclaiming the day. How's he thinking about today on the anniversary?
I think, you know, he just wants to, I think we both want to just get past it, you know, and tomorrow will be a whole different day. And there's a lot that leads up to today for us, and it's always a relief when today is over. But, you know, he's good, and, you know, he ran the Boston Marathon last year for the Ed Walsh Foundation, one of his fellow firefighters out of his firehouse that died in the Beacon Street fire. So definitely important to him to do that. And, you know, I think he's looking to enjoy this one because last year he was miserable. So I think we're both going to go in and spend the day with family and friends.
And I understand that you've been to the marathon as a spectator in the years since the bombing, and you're going again today. Why do you go? Why is it important for you to do that?
I don't want someone to take something from me, and I feel like they have taken enough already. So I have no control over how they took my leg, but I do have control over how they take the day. And so it's something that I think is important for me to go in. Although I do think next year, I think I'm going to take the year off, I think, and just and maybe do something for ourselves.
Well, you know, I was thinking about that it must get exhausting for you. I mean, we're grateful to have you on our show again this year. And I know you've done a lot of motivational speaking and you've written a book, Perfect Strangers. But I mean, do you ever wish you could just kind of reclaim your privacy?
I can control that a little bit with respect to it. And things have really died down in the aspect of like being out and someone seeing my prosthetic and asking me, oh, are you from the marathon? So that's been good. And I also think that I maybe torture myself a little bit by signing myself up for so many different things in and around this time of the year. But and then it's all over and it's gone by quickly. And then we're on to another year. So it's all good.
I know that through the speaking and the book, you've been sort of a symbol of strength for a lot of folks. And I'm wondering what you can say about the city. You know, as I was coming in to the studio today, I was seeing a lot of those Boston Strong shirts that everybody was wearing in the aftermath of the bombing in 2013. Has the city really lived up to that motto over the last 6 years, in your view?
Absolutely. I think Boston is a resilient city. I think us residents that live here and are from here, I think we are definitely a different breed. And I think probably what got me through a lot of the early days of everything, whether it was me personally with having that attitude or those that helped support me along the way who have that attitude, I think that's what's gotten me through a lot of it.
So what's your message for runners today and for your fellow spectators along the course?
Oh, boy. Good luck. Stay as dry as you can and just take your time. You know, it doesn't matter what your time is. It just matters if you finish. So good luck to all of them, and I'll be there cheering people on.
Well, Roseanne Sedoya, thank you so much for joining us again this year.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Roseanne Sedoya is a Boston Marathon bombing survivor, a motivational speaker, and author of the book Perfect Strangers. And before we take a break, we want to hear from one of the people running today. Andy Burnham is the mayor of Manchester, England, the site of a 2017 suicide bombing at an Ariana Grande concert.
It's a lot of emotion, isn't it? You know, so I'll be thinking of all of those people who were injured, who lost their lives at Boston, and obviously the many families here still going through the trauma of that. So I will be thinking of all of them. Today will be a tough day for them. But of course, I'm running in memory of the 22 people we lost in Manchester and everybody suffering back at home. So all of those thoughts will be in my mind. And you know, in the end, what we're all trying to do in our different ways is turn it to a positive, isn't it? To say, look, we won't let these terrorists divide us. We won't let you make us fearful, hateful of each other. In fact, you know, we're going to do the opposite. We're going to come together and stand strong together.
Mayor Andy Burnham of Manchester, England, running the Boston Marathon today. And a live update, Andy Burnham is on Comm Ave, just passing Boston College. He's about 21 miles in. Good job, Mr. Mayor. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Callum Borchers, and this is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. Today is one of those truly special days in Boston, as more than 30,000 runners make their way 26.2 miles from the starting line in Hopkinton to the finish line on Boylston Street near Copley Square. And joining us from the finish line is WBUR reporter Shannon Dooling. Hi, Shannon.
Hi, Callum.
So I know you've been talking with some of the non-elite runners as they finish. I'm sure you've heard some incredible stories of personal motivation. What has stood out to you so far?
Yeah, you know, I think one of the things that stood out most to me is just marathons are all about resilience, right? And this being sort of a special day, April 15th, it's the first anniversary of the marathon bombings falling on the same date as they occurred in 2013. And that has been on the mind of several people. You know, there have been sort of stories of people who didn't finish last year in the really rainy, cold, hypothermic conditions and who came back out this year to try to finish. It's such a great day in Boston. It's just a wonderful day to be out in the city and talking to people.
Well, you mentioned those awful conditions of last year, Shannon, and it was pretty soggy this morning. The sun peaked out for a while, but as we were coming on the air, the clouds were rolling back in. What's the current weather situation?
Yeah. It's been kind of all over the place. Very, quintessential New England today. We had some sun most of the day, but now, you know, we see more of the charity runners coming through the finish line. People are doing that limp, the post-26.2 marathon limp. The weather right now, there's some showers that are coming through Copley Square, but right now I'm standing outside. It is not raining at the moment, but the clouds are pretty menacing. I wouldn't be surprised if we get another shower or two.
And I know that you've been talking with some runners about how they're processing the anniversary that is sort of the theme running throughout the day. What have they been telling you?
Yeah, it's interesting because I spoke with one or two people who told me that yesterday before the race, they made a point to sort of walk down Boylston and visit the memorial spots on Boylston and sort of just take stock of what this day means for the city, for themselves, for people who were here in 2013. One of the gentlemen I spoke with who actually ran Boston Marathon in 2013, a gentleman named Tim Gentry. He's from Denver, Colorado. I think we have a little bit of my interview with him. Let's take a listen.
You know, it was pretty surreal. I was done, but it's a mess, you know.
He got choked up. You can tell there. I asked him what he remembered from 2013. He said there, I was done, but it was just kind of surreal. His eyes got a little teary when he was thinking back to 2013, but he finished today. He had a smile on his face as he was waiting for his family And he said, this, you know, this marathon is just the pinnacle. It's the pinnacle of running for marathoners and for elites and for non-elites alike. And it was pretty special for him, he said, to come back today, have a great race, and just be a part of Boston on Boston Marathon Monday.
WBUR's Shannon Dooling at the finish line. Thanks so much for bringing us those stories.
You're welcome, Callum.
And today, as we mentioned, marks the 6th anniversary of the Boston Marathon bombings, and it is the first time the anniversary falls on the same day as the race itself. Daniel Linsky was one of the key law enforcement figures at the center of Boston's response to the attack. He's now in the private sector, but in 2013, he was the superintendent-in-chief of the Boston Police Department. He was at the finish line soon after the explosions and was in the command post in Watertown a few days later during the manhunt that ended with the arrest of Jahar Tsarnaev. That month, Linsky spoke at a special WBUR forum, and he talked about the moment when he first learned of the bombings on a call from one of his sergeants.
There was so much noise and so much confusion. I didn't know what Danny had, but I know that Danny Keelan needed me on Boylston Street. So I ran over the bridge into Kenmore Square. By that time, one of my deputy superintendents was there, and they'd received a phone call that there was some type of explosion at the finish line. When I turned onto the street, I got out and I got briefed, and Danny told me, they hit us twice, boss.
Around this time last year, Linsky sat down with Radio Boston's host at the time, Meghna Chakrabarty. We want to revisit their powerful conversation, which began when Meghna played the clip we just heard and asked Linsky what it's like to relive the chaos years later.
It's chilling. It still brings back the horrifying memories of what our victims endured that day, what our officers had to see, our first responders had to see. I remember that forum. I just went back to being on Boylston Street and remembering Danny Keel, who did an amazing job and saved dozens of lives by instituting the plan, stepping up and commanding that scene, making sure that the street didn't get blocked. As Danny said, we get hit twice. We were standing in front of the Forum restaurant, and there was a young police officer that I had stopped along the way. And every year I walked that route when I was in charge as the incident commander to, one, thank my cops for what they do every day for us in the city of Boston, and two, make sure we're doing our job looking for bombs and EOD, making sure that there are no devices. I have a unique personal experience where my best friend's dad was a Boston police officer. He's the reason I became a cop. And I unfortunately responded to his scene when he was killed by a bomb in Rosendale, Massachusetts. And he was yelling at the officers there that there are secondary devices and that they shouldn't leave him. They didn't. But when Danny said that to me, I had met this young officer. I was walking, shaking hands. He told me he was my new neighbor. He was buying a house 5 houses up from me. And I talked to him for 20 minutes about the neighborhood and schools and places to eat. And went and did our assignment that day. And when I got back there, that officer had been injured.
Yeah.
And next to him was a little boy who was murdered by these terrorists and a young, beautiful woman who was murdered by these terrorists. And along with the horror of that image, I also share with you that there was a wave of shame and guilt that I spent 20 minutes talking about where I live and our neighborhood and good places to eat. And I took my eye off of my mission to look for unattended backpacks and bombs, and I was afraid that I'd walk by that backpack and missed it, and that that family's loss was on my soul and my responsibility. It wasn't until Wednesday morning when I realized that the bag was there for 6 or 7 minutes, but that was a burden I carried that day, and that's why when you play that tape, I'm immediately back on that scene, looking at that horror, and at the same time looking at, in awe, reflecting at what happened there, where our cops, our firefighters, our medics, our citizens just stepped up and did amazing things to limit the loss of life. We lost so much that day.
Daniel Linsky, can I just jump in here for a second?
Sure.
Because you and I, we've talked a bunch of times in the past 5 years. I don't think you've ever told me that about the guilt that you carried. About I didn't know you'd walk right by the backpack.
I didn't.
I mean, that you took 20 minutes to talk.
And, yeah. And like I say, I know I don't think there was a law enforcement official who feared bombs more than me, based on the death of Jerry Hurley. That I'd saw the horror that day that it happened to him personally, and the family after his death. So, it's not something I bring up. You got me in the moment when you played that audio tape again and brought me back to the time on the street. But we were ready, and we were prepared, and we were doing everything we could. Unfortunately, you can't prevent every threat. The commission is going to challenge this year with new threats that have come out in our country and our world that we have to address. He's addressing them. The men and women of the BPD, the fire, EMS, medical staff, they'll address them.
Yeah.
And hopefully our secret weapon will help us address them, which is the Boston Strong Community. It's, you know, we had 834 police officers on the street that day. For Boston PD, there were about 1 million people. So now if we add those, we have 2 million eyes that can help out Boston Police, make sure that, just like Jeff Bauman, when he saw Tim Unzenayev arrive, he looked at him, he assessed him, he realized he was a threat. He thought he was acting suspicious. And when he came out of his induced coma, he immediately notified us that he saw who
did it. He said he saw the guy.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So it works.
Can I just ask you, and forgive me, because, you know, my job is to press a little sometimes.
Sure.
But you opened the door here. I don't think I've ever asked you how much that day changed you. How much did it change you?
Immensely. It changed me immensely. Thankful for... I sometimes do presentations to other law enforcement and have shared some of the lessons that we learned that day, the good and the bad. We did a lot of things right. We made a lot of mistakes, too. And sharing that information has been helpful. But when I do those presentations, it's raw. I can't fathom the challenges and the losses that the victims who were deceased and their families have gone through these past 5 years, the challenges of the victims who lost limbs and were horrifically injured. I think it changed our entire country.
Mm-hmm.
We kind of gotten complacent after 9/11, and it woke us back up again that we need to be resilient, and I think we were. But it forever changed me. It forever changed the Boston Police Department and forever changed our city.
How did it change you?
If you drop a dish near me, my son will tell you, I have a startle reflex that's probably not healthy, not appropriate. It's made me think more tactically and be more cynical when I'm looking at events and security for our clients to make sure that I'm, probably overdoing and looking at things that maybe will never, ever happen. But it's makes me, with the folks I work with, try and go to the extent we can to ensure every potential detail and every potential threat is addressed. It's made me thankful for my family, my kids, my world, made me ever proud of being a member of that police department and having the joy of working with the men and women through that event.
Yeah. Thinking about the complexity of assuring the safety of a million people and more than 30,000 runners, and how I feel like every year since then, it's gotten more complex, right? Because, of course, every member of law enforcement at every level is thinking about all the possible risks, but... as we heard Commissioner Evans say at the top of our conversation, it seems like every year there's a whole new set of risks to have to think about. I mean, how manageable is that for law enforcement?
I think law enforcement, their mission and the things they can do to make people safe is constantly evolving. I wasn't in the law enforcement career when the Texas Tower event happened, but I'm sure that changed the conversations that law enforcement was having about issues with high elevated positions. And it seemed like a long time before we had another one that truly impacted our country. There's always challenges. And the thing is not to have the plan. You need a plan. But more important than the plan is training a whole cadre of people, training your organization to plan.
Yeah.
I had a great plan, 146 pages, I think it was. We actually had a secondary route on Boylston Street if a fire truck had to be there and put a fire out, that we would just blow open barriers. And we had a secondary timing mat, and we'll have it again this year, that you would just continue running down Commonwealth Avenue, and it would be the exact distance that the runners would need for their qualifying time. We had that level of detail. Mm-hmm. However, when we get hit, we didn't have a plan for, okay, we've gotten two bombs, we've got three dead, 254 wounded. We had some contingency plans we'd put in place, and what we did is get our teams to look and assess the situation and come up with the response. And that's one of the things we try to do is to make sure we're ready for the response and that we can be robust and flexible.
Yeah. Daniel Alinsky, I can't thank you enough. I mean, you've come in here a lot in the past 5 years, and you surprised me this time. So thank you so much for sharing some stuff, which is still real to this day, even though it's been 5 years. Thank you.
I can't believe it's 5 years. It seems like 5 seconds, and yet it seems like five decades, yeah, depending on your view.
That's former Boston Police Superintendent in Chief Daniel Alinsky speaking with former Radio Boston host Meghna Chakrabarty last April. Another person whose life was profoundly impacted by the marathon bombings is Dave Fortier. In 2013, he was running to support a friend who'd been diagnosed with cancer when he was injured in the first explosion. He suffered shrapnel wounds and hearing loss. He went on to found the One World Strong Foundation, which aids survivors of terror and trauma. Fortier is on the course right now, running Boston for the seventh time, and is on pace to finish soon. Radio Boston's own Eve Zukoff met with him at the starting line this morning and asked how he was feeling as he prepared to hit the pavement.
Actually feeling great. You know, really happy. Kind of tired. Been doing a lot of traveling over the last week, but it's great to be back here in Hopkinton. You know, I know what's ahead of me on the course in Boston. With screaming people and everybody happy, and this is kind of a holiday for a lot of us. And to be able to get out here and do the marathon like this, year over year now, our group is growing. We have a wonderful relationship with the Semper Fi Fund. Those are the folks that came here and helped us after we were injured here in Boston. And now we work with them in different places across the country, and they've shown us how to do this in different places across the world. So it's a great relationship.
Tell me a little bit about how have you prepared this year? Is it different at all?
I'm probably the least prepared this year. we've actually been doing a lot with the foundation. So there's been a lot of travel. It's taken me away from the training piece. So by far, this is the most untrained I've ever been for a marathon. I'll admit that right now to you. So whatever happens in the next 26.2 miles, so We'll see what happens when we get to Boylston Street, if we get to Boylston Street. But I'm just really excited about what's been accomplished in the last year. We now work in over 15 countries. You know, we're working with literally hundreds of survivors around the world now. It's really exciting to see this being put together.
Yeah, tell me a little bit more about what the organization is, what it does, why it matters.
Sure. So we're folks that were injured ourselves in extremist or terrorist attacks. And we work with survivors of those attacks. We work with families that have lost loved ones. And we work with first responders. And first responders, because they're so important to us. Those are folks that helped us in Boston immediately. And the Semper Fi Fund came here to visit us. Those are Marines that were injured in Iraq and Afghanistan. And those people were just amazing. You know, it wasn't a one-time visit to say, hey, you're going to be okay. It was... They told us we'd be okay, but they told us why, because they had experienced something similar. So now that's what we do with folks around the world. We actually work with folks like they worked with us. It's not a one-time visit, right? We'll be here in a week, we'll be here in a year, you know, we'll be here in 10 years. So we're 6 years from the Boston Marathon, right? 6 years ago today, this all happened. We now have, I've lost count of how many of the Marines are here with us today. That had been injured in similar ways, but they're actually here with us today, 6 years later. And you can't say that for a lot of people that come to visit you in the hospital afterwards. And now we do that for folks around the world. Doesn't matter where people are. Doesn't matter what religion you are. Doesn't matter what race you are. Doesn't matter what color you are. Doesn't matter what your politics are. It's about people helping people. It's peer-to-peer humanitarian diplomacy.
And tell me a little bit more about what it's like to be running on the 6 year anniversary. What does that feel like?
It's pretty magical, actually, because out of all that bad that happened that day, so much good has come from, and all the different foundations that have been developed out of Boston, all the people that are being helped out of Boston. Yeah, there were some very sad things and horrible things happened to people. People lost loved ones. But being able to see how people rally in Boston and then to carry that out into other countries and other cities and how this has developed over time, it really is pretty amazing. Now, of course, we're going to be thinking about all this. I mean, I can't even imagine what the emotions will be when we get to Boylston Street today. I imagine there'll be a lot of emotion. But the feeling and where we've come from in the last 6 years, the stories of resiliency are amazing. And it's sharing those stories with others that can help other people recover after these events. That's the magical part of this, is being able to reach out and help others like others helped us.
That's 2013 Boston Marathon bombing survivor Dave Fortier, founder and president of the One World Strong Foundation, speaking with Radio Boston's Eve Zukoff. And he is on the course right now, running through Cleveland Circle with just about 4 miles to go. Go, Dave. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. Winter is here, on television anyway. Game of Thrones is back for its final season on HBO, and according to The Hollywood Reporter, last season drew some 33 million viewers. Harvard professor Rasha Kirakosian says Game of Thrones creator George R.R. Martin got a lot of his inspiration from real medieval history. Kirakosian is a professor of German and a scholar of medieval mysticism and history at Harvard, where she teaches a course called The Real Game of Thrones. And she joins me now in studio. Welcome to Radio Boston, Professor.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be here.
Now, we asked you here to talk about Game of Thrones, and I promise we'll get to that in a moment. But I do have to ask you about the fire raging at the Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris right now, because it's a Gothic icon, and I know that you studied in Paris for a while. So I'm wondering if you can help give us some appreciation of what's at stake right now as firefighters try to save it.
Yeah, it's absolutely shocking and devastating news, and I just found out, actually, as I'm sitting here in the studio. It is, like you say, a Gothic icon that was started in 1163, not as the first Gothic church. The first one was Saint-Denis, just outside Paris back then. And it really developed until the 14th century, and in further centuries it continued to grow. And so Notre Dame itself can be seen as this laboratory for architects, artists, musicians, church people, clerics, this long-term laboratory. And so it is more than just a sign of radiating Gothic art. It is also a symbol for power, both for the Catholic Church, but also for the secular power. And you think about all the judgments that were made in Notre Dame Cathedral, and then also Notre Dame Cathedral could be described as the very beginning of universities today. So that's really where the universities start, at the Notre Dame Cathedral schools. Of course, it's more complicated than that, but just to cut it short, it's absolutely devastating to see this burn, and the pictures alone just really, to be poetic, burn in my heart, right? It's very sad.
Yeah, it's heartbreaking to watch, especially, I mean, of all times, during Holy Week, with given the symbolism of the cathedral for Catholics and Christians around the world. And, of course, you mentioned the art factor. There's a priceless collection of art there. And I was just thinking about how there's the fire itself, but also, you know, if you just douse it with water, the damage you could do as you try to save it as well. It just seems like an incredibly delicate situation right now.
Absolutely. And I'm not sure, I haven't had time to research how the French are dealing with it, but my heart goes out to the French right now.
All right. I do want to get to the reason that we brought you here, which is to talk about medieval history, your coursework at Harvard. and Game of Thrones. And I will just mention off the top that we are going to be talking about the show, but we won't get into the specifics of last night's episode. So no spoilers there. But there will be a little bit of a spoiler if you don't know anything about the show and you're just coming in cold. So let me just begin with this course that you teach. You got a lot of attention when you introduced it a couple of years ago, right? Yeah. Game of Thrones getting the Harvard treatment. Right. But remind us what goes on in the classroom.
Right. So this class called The Real Game of Thrones, Culture, Society, and Religion in the Middle Ages is neither a survey class on Game of Thrones nor a survey class on the Middle Ages. But actually, what I'm trying to do here is to take the curiosity for the Middle Ages that we see evoked in Game of Thrones, in the worldwide appeal with people watching it and associating this often the so-called Dark Ages with it, and channeling this curiosity to actually inquire into our own world history, to take this as an opportunity to critically deal with phenomena of cultural appropriation of the past, of the medieval past, of narratives. And that also leads us to how during the Romantic period, medievalism meant that the Middle Ages were revived in an imaginary fashion. And also we also deal with phenomena such as Orientalism and the connection between femininity and bestiality. So I really invite undergraduates to test and challenge their assumptions about the Middle Ages, because, you see, quite often they feel informed enough through fantasy and video games and historical fiction at best, but these forms of entertainment do not supply a filter for how to distinguish history from fantasy.
Yeah, I became an expert when I watched Disney's Sword in the Stone as a kid, right?
So it's fantastic. The same thing.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, but it sounds like you're hoping that students will, you know, their interest in the real Middle Ages will be piqued by watching Game of Thrones. And we know that the show's executive producer and the author of the books it's based on, George R.R. Martin, did dive deeply into real history as he was creating this fantasy world. Here he is talking about his research process in a 2017 interview in Helsinki.
For Game of Thrones, I've totally immersed myself in reading histories of the Middle Ages and the Wars of the Roses, the Hundred Years' War, the Albigensian Crusade, all of the stuff that I thought I could steal from.
So it sounds like Martin basically took, you know, retook AP European history there before he got into the writing process. Where do you see that show up in Game of Thrones, the real stuff?
Right. So it's really hard to answer that, because he doesn't align the historical model one-to-one in his world building of the show. And that's the thing about fantasy. It doesn't need to be accurate. It doesn't try to be accurate, right? So this kind of inspiration is the key word here. It's inspiration and stimulation, but not imitation. Just to pick one thing that he mentions in the interview, Wars of the Roses. So let's say it has inspired the plot that deals with the tensions between House Stark and House Lannister, which is the starting point from which the entire story of Game of Thrones unfolds. And the Wars of the Roses were a series of wars about the throne of England fought between supporters of two rival branches of the royal house, of the Plantagenet. And so they are called the House of Lancaster, associated with the Red Rose. And there you can already hear Lancaster and Lannister, right? That affinity. And the House of York, which sounds a lot like Stark. And of course, South and North also, that alignment. The conflict lasted through many sporadic episodes between 1455 and 1487. And there was fighting before and after this period. And this whole power struggle ignited around social and financial troubles following the Hundred Years' War. However, these plot lines infuse the world of Game of Thrones, but there is so much more to the world of Game of Thrones. So aligning it one by one is really hard. I mean, another example would be Hadrian's Wall and the Ice Wall, right? So George R. Martin says that he took Hadrian's Wall as an inspiration for the Ice Wall and just, you know, blowing it up literally and making it much bigger. And this is a formidable example, actually, to show how stimulation and inspiration does not mean imitation. Because Hadrian's Wall was a defensive barrier, yes. On the one hand, it granted to guard the northern frontier of the province of Britain from Celtic invaders. But on the other hand, it also signaled to the same tribes of north of the wall that the expansion would not stretch further. And actually, this Hadrian's Wall was what historians think to be a factor of economic boom because movement was taxed. So movement across the world was actually welcome because it was taxed. And the Roman soldiers brought goods such as oil and wine, and they consumed goods and services that farmers, laborers, prostitutes, traders, and craftsmen were eager to supply, right? So it was not that isolated, sad landmark that the ice wall is in Game of Thrones, but it must have been buzzing with life.
So how does that translate for contemporary viewers now? Because the wall, is certainly very much in our news right now. So what should viewers of Game of Thrones perhaps be learning and thinking about as they process the news at the same time?
Well, that's quite a political question. Give me a moment to think about that. Well, what I would say is that, like any good fantasy world, the fantasy world can teach us more about our own world than actually about an imaginary world. And that's why it is often so appealing, right, to see parallels to our own world. And there, the consumer is, of course, invited to be reflected about what we see, how it might resonate with our own world and what we can take from it, right? And the wall in particular, that's an interesting issue because some people have seen the ice wall in Game of Thrones as also a sign for climate change and sort of migration because of climate change, because we see in the early seasons how the so-called wildlings actually try to escape winter, right? And so try to actually mass migrate. And that is so linked to climate change. When we think about that, that's actually quite actual in our own world.
So there's a lot for us to learn and process and think about while we are also entertained.
Absolutely.
Rasha Kirakosian is a professor of German and the study of religion at Harvard, where she teaches a course on medieval history and Game of Thrones. Professor, thank you so much for your time today.
Yeah, it's a pleasure.
And I'll just mention as well that NPR will have continuing coverage of the Notre Dame Cathedral fire coming up on All Things Considered. And finally today, let's finish strong with the big race in Boston. It's been classic Boston weather for a classic Boston event. We've had some lightning, sun, driving rain, a warm breeze, a little of everything since the starting gun went off. As 30,000 runners took off from Hopkinton this morning, all with their own training experiences, challenges, and motivations, we caught up with one of them to find out why she's pushing herself to run 26.2 miles today.
My name's Karen Morgan, and I'm from Westford, Mass. I run for 50 Legs, which is an organization that provides prosthetics to amputees. This is my fourth year in a row running for them. A friend of mine was running in 2013, Carmen Acabo, and her sister and her niece were at the finish line. Her sister lost both of her legs, and this is the organization that really gave her life back. So I decided to run for them in 2016, and I just became hooked on what this organization does. I now run for this little girl, Katie, as you can see on the back of my shirt. Katie is a 10-year-old girl from Kentucky who is an amputee, and she's been the inspiration for my run. So that's why I'm doing it.
And Karen Morgan is approaching Cleveland Circle with about 4 miles to go. For a final thought, we want to bring back WBUR marathon reporter Alex Ashlock. As a reminder, he was on the women's lead truck today, and he is joining us now from the finish line. Alex, thanks for sticking around.
Happy to do it, Callum.
All right, so I'm just wondering, what are your final takeaways from today's race? There was a lot to process. We had the anniversary. We had some really history-making performances. What stands out in your mind? How will you remember this event?
I think, first of all, those performances you mentioned, Worknesh Degefa of Ethiopia just simply ran away from the women's race. There was nobody even close to her at the end. She was ahead by more than 4 minutes at one point. She ran by herself for a lot of the race. There were parts of the course where there weren't very many fans, and it was just very quiet. I was just thinking she must be feeling like she's out on a training run. And then you had that great finish in the men's race, a complete opposite of the women's race. You had these two African runners sprinting down Boylston Street, Lawrence Chirono barely edging out Elisa De Sisa by only 2 seconds, one of the closest finishes in decades. Just a great race. So just great performances today in this Boston Marathon. Also in the wheelchairs, Manuela Schar winning on the women's side, and the young Daniel Romanchuk winning on the men's side. So that's one of the those are the things I'm going to take away today.
And it strikes me, Alex, that you know this was a day that the city really had to handle really competing emotions at the same time. Remembering the tragedy of 6 years ago and also celebrating the marathon and all it has meant for the other 122 years. And it seemed to me that the city really pulled it off well today.
I would say they did. There was an acknowledgement this afternoon at 2:49 p.m., the moment the first bombs exploded. The bells rang at Old South Church. It wasn't really a moment of silence because thousands of people were still finishing the marathon, but in some ways that seemed appropriate 6 years later, the 2 days coinciding, the two things coinciding, the anniversary and the actual race, because, people want to move on. People want the race to continue. Survivors of the marathon bombings are running the race these days. So it's come full circle, you might say, in some ways. So I think the city did a good job today putting both things in perspective.
That's WBUR marathon reporter Alex Ashlock at the finish line. Alex, thanks for your time.
You're welcome.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Callum Borchers. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.